Okay, so my deal today is going to be on Venn diagrams and the square of opposition. You have a little something on the end of your notes, truth trees. I'm just introducing it and probably just introducing it visually. We're probably not going to get to it just because I don't want to clutter up things. I'd rather spend more time on less things, seeing that we only have 7 weeks anyway. We might as well not try to kill ourselves and just introduce things. So that's what we're doing, Venn diagrams and the square of opposition. I'll show you the relationship between them. There's also a relationship between Venn diagrams and truth functions. Poythress has a chapter on that too. It's the same thing. You're basically checking your work in a visual way. We're just not going to get to it. Okay? But this will be a good enough introduction to you. So now we're moving from the description of the laws of logic and simple demonstrations for validity to another aspect of form that is more visual. You might even think about this as logic's aesthetic dimension, if you're really nerdy, I guess. You can think of this as logic's aesthetic dimension. But the big idea I have here is that deductive logic has a visual form. Hopefully, by the end of this, you will not just think of this as how to check your work. You'll also think of this as a way to do two things. One, to graphically demonstrate, for example, the kind of things that Josh just showed you about necessary, some things being bigger than other things, and drawing an arrow that represents that ontologically. Hopefully that's one thing you get out of it. Another thing is a means of discovering things, which is not really different from the first point, but discovering something that I'm going to show you over here, and one of the things you're going to see discovered, I'll try to remember to represent it every time I check a syllogism with a Venn diagram. I'm going to show you an arrow, and this is what they won't show you in logic class, an arrow traveling from smaller things to bigger things in the circles that remain after you exit out. And that's going to show you something about being. We'll see it. Okay, so a little bit of background. First, Venn diagrams. This guy, Euler, actually came before Venn. Okay, he was a Swiss mathematician, Leonard Euler, and his dates are 1707 to 1783. He first used simple circles to represent the logical relationship between the general and the specific, between the subject and the predicate. John Venn, his dates were 1834 to 1923, so he was a mathematical logician. He existed within the framework of Boole, and he was a mathematician too. They really did a lot of streamlining of Aristotelian logic. So there's kind of two extremes and misunderstandings. On the one hand, modern symbolic logic is not a different logic than Aristotle's logic. That's a misnomer. But on the other hand, there were things that, starting with Boole and eventually, for sure, Bertrand Russell did deliberately to get beyond traditional Western logic. And as Gordon Clark and other people have pointed out, they failed. They failed tremendously. So all the things that symbolic modern logic does that's better is an extension of Aristotelian logic and not a displacement of it. That's very important to know, because that'll actually be one of the objections against the Christian faith. Huh? Yeah, it will, so just ask me afterwards. Okay. But this guy, Venn, what he was doing was he was coming up with a system that represents the information given by categorical propositions. And his system works with both traditional Aristotelian logic and that square of opposition. I'm also going to tell you that there's a difference between the traditional square of opposition and the modern version. But we'll get to that in the second half of what we do. Venn's diagram focuses on the intersection of qualities. You see that? Dogs, animals, and collies are the three sets or the three circles I have up there right now. In the Euler diagram, you see collies inside of dogs, which is inside of animals, those circles. Okay, you might be thinking, man, why would you use the first one? Well, we'll see that. But Venn's intersecting circles allow us to see all the potential combinations for A, B, and C, whichever they are. They're, in other words, what the terms have in common. And, you know, when you see ones that are big enough, if I put, hat wearers and baseball players as my two circles, and I intersect them, then immediately you're like, okay, I can see that. Now I'm dealing with equals. I can imagine non-baseball playing hat wearers, and I can imagine baseball playing without wearing a hat, and then in this intersecting field, those are people that wear a hat while they're playing baseball. I get that. But when you're talking about things that are species of other things, why would you have them intersect like that? We'll see that. Okay, so let's imagine, I said baseball play, what's the example I actually had, I don't think I have it on your notes, but I have it in my chapter, is A, Dominicans, and D, shortstops. And if you know anything about baseball in the last 30 years, this is a very big field. And this over here on the right is a very small field. Shortstops that are not big. But anyway, in the middle, obviously, and this is what you'd call an intersecting field, and you just call it AB, because it'd be what A and B have in common. Now, of course, there's going to be Dominicans that don't play shortstops. I mean, what are you, a racist? Of course there are. And there's shortstops that are not Dominicans. All right? But in this intersecting field, A and B, and by the way, that's a compliment. Being a shortstop, last time I checked, was a pretty good thing. Makes you a lot of money. There you go. Okay? But the valid intersecting field will be the predicates shared, so that if we imagine two intersecting circles, one being Dominican, the other being shortstop, and the intersecting field will be Dominican shortstops. Now, in a syllogism, obviously, you're moving from an A and a B to an A, B, and a C. Okay? So let's erase this and look back over at that one on the left, that Venn diagram with three sets. In a syllogism, there's more than two terms. There's three. Now, you remember what I mean by terms. If I have three propositions, two of which are premises, and the third is a conclusion, there's three terms. Otherwise, it's invalid. You got a major term. That's up there in your major premise, and it's the predicate of your conclusion. You got a minor term, and that's in your minor premise, and it's the subject of your conclusion. And then you've got that one that connects your major and your minor premise, and that's the middle term. So you've got three terms in a syllogism. So what would this look like? Well, first of all, let's look at how the individual terms are represented. You begin with that diagram. The two on the top, in this case, dogs and animals. And then the third one, the third term represented on bottom. It's a bit like an Olympic symbol with the two other, you know, world peace rings just kind of fell off. All right? And so you got those three things left. I'm trying to describe it for people that are not looking at the board right there. But that's how it would be represented right there. And these name terms, these classes or these circles. So this is what it would look like as a syllogism. All dogs are animals. That's premise one. Premise two, all collies are dogs. Conclusion, therefore, all collies are animals. Now, first of all, let's just check that the way we first learned to, by looking at the terms. So this is the first easiest way you check your work. You say, first of all, what are the parts? Well, let's first just look at a middle term. For me, that's the easiest thing to check because I know it's got to be there in the major and the minor premises. Well, there you go. It's dogs. I've got my middle term. So that's right. What about my major term? There it is in my major premise, and sure enough, it shows up as the predicate in my conclusion. So that's right. That's good. Okay, what about my minor term? There it is. It's the subject of my second premise, and it's the right where it should be, the subject of my conclusion. So that is perfectly valid, assuming that I haven't equivocated on my terms and all that good stuff. That looks like a valid syllogism. So, how do we check that? Well, we move from that simplest representation, and we start, and you could do this with X's or shading in. There's actually other ways to do it too. But the two basic ways, on a computer, an X is what I would recommend, because how do you shade? I'm sure somebody knows how to do it. I'm sure the Mac can do it, but I can't on a PC, so I just use X's. And I do it in PowerPoint, because I'm pathetic and I don't know how else to do things. And I do it in PowerPoint, and I slap it into my Word doc, okay? So, but if you're on a board, you could shade it out or whatever out. Yes, and here's what you do. You shade out the things, you just start with your premises. Well, it says all dogs are animals. So, this is going to answer your question from before. Why would I have these intersecting fields? Because what dog isn't an animal? Well, exactly. That's what the premise says. All dogs are animals. So what am I going to do? I'm going to shade out or X out everything in the class of dogs that are not also in the class animals. So you see that? Now notice I still have this intersecting field that are both dogs and animals. Okay? Second premise, all collies are dogs. Well, if that's the case, then I have to X out or shade out everything in the set collies that is not also an animal. Okay? And I did that wrong. You see what I did wrong? There's also a side hanging out there because a collie's a dog. Okay? So I said that wrong. All collies are dogs is my second premise. So my focus has to be anything that's not in the set of dogs. So I have to actually take that out too. Even though it's hanging out there in the animal class, so's that. And that's going to be where we put our thumbs up and say it's good. Our premise we leave out of it. Because the standard is, do my two premises by themselves give me enough information to check out exactly what I need to check out? I'm going to say that in a more definitive way when we get there. We're just going to go through a couple of exercises and do this. Now, I told you, as much as I can remember, I'm going to show you this cool thing about being, about predication. You're going to notice that in a Venn diagram, when you're checking a syllogism, all that remains is going to flow from the smallest thing. You're going to be able to do this, if it's a valid syllogism, up to the biggest thing. And here's the thing, you're left with a Euler diagram. If you do a Venn diagram right, you're left with a Euler diagram. Okay? So, another way to state all this different stuff is just that on the board. And the arrow's going to go this way, from collies up through dogs, if it's a collie, it's a dog. And if a dog is an animal, well then a collie is an animal. Okay? So, of course, there are no collies that are not also dogs, and therefore animals, which implies also, another way to say it, no dogs are non-animals. Or, if anything is a dog, it is not non-animal. So, these terms I don't have in your notes, so let me just, these are just basic terms I kind of took for granted, so I forgot. These words right here, so let me just write them up there. The words class, so I don't say these words over and over again and have you say, what is he talking about? The word intersecting field or intersecting region. I should really look intersecting. Region. Region or field are going to mean the same thing. You can say it either way. And then the third term I'm going to use is complement. So let me define what each of these means so that every time I use these, they're not going to be staring at me like, what do you mean by that word? Okay? So the class, when I say the word class, I mean the whole of each term discussed. So I could be using class as a synonym for set, which could be used as a synonym for, you see that circle right there? That's the dog circle. Everything in that circle is dog. That's what the class of dogs. Okay, the whole of each term discussed. That second definition or grammar word right there, intersecting region, represents what two or more classes have in common. So remember that Dominican shortstop field, AB? So let's just pretend I didn't have collies up here, but I had dogs and animals. If dogs are A and animals are B, well then that intersecting part would be AB. That would be my intersecting region. And then that third word, complement, is the whole region outside of the region in question, namely its opposite. So the complement region to animals would be non-animals. So if animals was B, then non-animals would be non-B, and that would be everything else. And I mean everything else, including the dog circle, the collie circle, everything that's outside animal would be non-B. That would be the complement region. Okay? Very exciting stuff. That's just so if I say it, that's what I mean. I was supposed to leave that up there, but I'll try to remember in the future. All right. Now, the advantage of the Venn diagram is that we can see all the various combinations of predicates that the sets have in common. In such a diagram, as we've seen, we can account for the dogs that are not animals by saying that there's no such thing, by simply Xing it out or shading it out in that region. However, there's an advantage to the Euler model. There's a more obvious representation of a species class being contained within a genus class, as you can see in that one, collies being contained within dogs, both being contained within animals. I believe I had in your notes also cats. So that would go right here, obviously separate from dogs, but also in that region and also pointing to a superior existence. All right. And I also mentioned there's also an inevitability to the Euler diagram. Once you X out everything in your Venn regions, you're left with a Euler diagram. For example, if dogs and animals were intersecting, we would have to X out anything dog that is not animal, and thus we'd be left with the traditional all dogs are animals. All S is P. Okay? So we might ask, what good are Venn diagrams? And the answer is that they allow us to check our work in a fairly simple way. Poitras adds to this that Euler diagrams can become more complicated if we have to consider more than one possibility for which area is included within which. Each circle, as we've said, represents one term in our categorical propositions. And three such circles can represent a syllogism. So let's take a famous example, both of the true and the false kind. Now, I'll give you a couple examples of valid syllogisms and invalid syllogisms just to keep getting our feet wet here. And here's the next one. Animals, mortal, and cats. So let's put that there. Let's see if these circles are any better. Slightly better. Not much. That one's having a hair treatment issue. Not sure about to get rid of that. And let me put up the syllogism first. Two premises, conclusion. Premise one, all animals are mortal. Premise two, all cats are animals. Conclusion, all cats are mortal. Now you're going to notice some of these I took from Poitras directly, and others they're just getting too boring, so I made up my own. But I did half and half to save time. So, what do we do here? Well, we check our work. Sorry, let me add the terms over here. I'll put animal over here in this circle, my A circle, mortal in my B circle, and cats in my C circle. Okay, so what are we doing here? We X out the fields that obviously are non-existent. First of all, we can follow our premises. All animals are mortal. So I gotta get rid of anything that is not, that is animal but not mortal. So that'll take those two out right there. Secondly, all cats are animals. So I'm going to take out that field of cats that are not contained in animals, and I'm going to take out that field as well. And voila, it looks exactly the same as the first diagram. Therefore, all cats are mortal. Okay, so let's check that the way we originally learned to. You got my middle term, animals, animals. My major term, mortal, and there it is the predicate in the conclusion. Minor term, cats, is the subject of the second premise, and sure enough, it's the subject of the conclusion. So that is a valid syllogism. It's the exact same form. You might recognize that and the first one we did as the Barbara syllogism. Remember? A. All animals are something. That's a universal affirmative. All cats are something. That's a universal affirmative. All cats, again, are something. So you're going to have type A categorical propositions all the way down. And that's a Barbara form. So that's at least the one that is the easiest to learn right away. So, let's look at another one. And this one is not going to be the same. Now I'm going to throw you off. First, I'll write the syllogism, and then we'll check our work. Here's the syllogism. All dogs are mammals. Well, that's true. Premise two, all cats are mammals. Well, that's true too. What could possibly go wrong here? Conclusion, all cats are dogs. Huh. Well, obviously that's not true. So what happened? Did we just happen to do that? Could we have done something else? Well, you might have, but the form is already messed up, and I'll show you how. Do you have a middle term here? Yeah, you got mammals. So let's just hold that right there. They're both mammals. That's what they have in common. Wow, what's the problem? Okay, well, let's start filling out our board here. Let's put cats over here. Dog class over here. So those are the two on top, cats and dogs. And then this bottom one, mammals. Okay? Where do my X's have to go? Let's look at the first premise. All dogs are mammals. Okay? That means I have to get rid of the dog class that's not in the mammal circle. Tick that out. All cats are mammals. Okay, so I have to take out anything that is a cat that's not a mammal. No such thing. Okay, so it should look like that. So what's the problem? The problem is not that it's shaded in here, because that would be applied to both cats and dogs. Does anybody see the problem, just visually? Yeah, the dogs that are cats inside here, because all cats are dogs. Okay? I mean, even if that were true, how would you wouldn't be able to put them there. And so the rule again is that everything we need has to be given in the premises. We can't get it from the conclusion. Because presumably, deductions working this way, a syllogism should give us everything we need so that this just naturally follows. I love the word follows. So it's such an easy word. This has to follow this. And so all we're looking at are the two premises, and we should have everything we need, but we don't. And so therefore, that is an invalid syllogism. And that's how we check our work, and we'll keep seeing it. Okay? So now, in layman's terms, here's what happened over there. The middle term never logically related the major and the minor term. And of course not, because no cat is a dog. Okay? So how does the diagram help? And this is when we're going to fill out our definition of what we mean by checking by Venn diagrams. And maybe I shouldn't have erased that. So, but here's what we mean. Is there a rule of demonstration by Venn diagrams? The technique of Venn diagrams for categorical syllogisms is based on the fact that in a valid syllogism, the conclusion asserts no more than what is already contained implicitly in the premises. That's just another way to say what I just said. Okay? The whole premise here of a categorical syllogism is that in a valid syllogism, the conclusion can assert no more than what is already contained implicitly in the premises. What you find here in the bucket is exactly the amount that came down. No more. Okay? It has to follow from the premises. And so, the Venn diagram is just a way, I think a simple way, once you get it, to visually demonstrate that. So, if the conclusion asserts more than that, it does not follow from the premises, and the syllogism is, by definition, invalid. So the technique or the rule, and here it is in your notes. This is the way it's written in your notes. So this is a rule, this is the law, and it's going to be a doing definition. It's a definition of what you do to check your work. Diagram the premises, and then see whether anything would have to be added in order to diagram what the conclusion asserts. If so, the syllogism is invalid. If not, it is valid. So do you understand what that rule means? If in checking my first two premises, I don't have everything I need to read the conclusion, I know it's invalid. So if I take my first two premises and I X out everything that needs to be X'd out in a given case, if I look at my conclusion, I should be able to look back at this and say, oh, it's already done. Good. But if I look at my conclusion and then look over at my Venn diagram and say, well, wait a minute, why is that not? That still has to be X'd. Then it's invalid. Everything I need should be contained in the two premises. The conclusion should follow. The conclusion should not add anything. The conclusion should follow. Okay? That's just a tortured way of me saying the law in various different ways. Thus, in the above syllogism, the reason it was invalid, sorry for erasing it, cat, dog, mammal, should be in your notes, I think. In that syllogism, the reason it was invalid in Venn terminology is that we would need to place an X in that portion of the AB field, the cat-dog field. not already excluded between cats and dogs. So we're not saying, hopefully we're not saying, that cats may be dogs after all, so long as they're also mammals. Well, of course they're both mammals, and then nevertheless they still can't be the same thing. They're different things. So let's put together everything we've seen to diagram a few syllogisms and see if they're valid. First one, this one would be a little bit more fun. Not really. But practical. Here's my circles. Note to self, stop erasing. Because then, you know, it's just easier to have them on the board when I start explaining what I'm talking about. So here's my syllogism. Premise one. Every sin, now is not the same as saying all sin. So that's a type A statement. Every sin deserves God's wrath. Premise two, unbelief is a sin. Therefore, unbelief, who can finish that sentence for me? Deserves God's wrath. Does that look valid? It is. You've got the middle term, sin. Here I have the universal class in my first premise. Here I have a part, a species of it, a particular. And that's my middle term, sin. What's my major term? God's wrath. And does it show up in the predicate of the conclusion, just like it's supposed to? Yes. Unbelief is my minor term, and it shows up as the subject of my conclusion, just like it's supposed to. So it looks like a valid syllogism, but just to be sure, let's diagram it in a Venn diagram. Over here in my A field, I'll have sin. Over here in my B, I'll have wrath, deserving. And over here in my C field on the bottom, I will have unbelief. Alright, what do I have to X out from my first premise? If I say every sin deserves God's wrath, what do I have to cross out? Yeah, because that would be contradictory to say that there is a sin or some sin does not deserve God's wrath. That would be a contradictory statement. And so be thinking about the square of opposition because we'll be getting there. Okay, so I've got to cross that out. What about the second premise, unbelief is a sin? What would I cross out there? Unbelief is not a sin. Yeah, so any unbelief is not a sin. That's already crossed out for me. So just the rest of that particular circle. Okay. So do I have exactly what I need in my conclusion? Oh, what happened?
One more.
I did something wrong. Oh, sorry. Unbelief is not a sin, right? Yeah. So if I cross that out, now I have everything I believe I need here. If I look at my conclusion and I see unbelief deserves God's wrath, is everything where it should be? Yeah. Move from unbelief. Now, notice that I'm left with a Euler at this point. Unbelief inside of sin, inside of wrath-deserving thing. And notice I'm moving from the particular, the species, to a genus class, which is itself the species of a larger genus class. Which means that the predicate of unbelief, namely sin, is larger than unbelief. And the predicate of unbelief, namely wrath-deserving thing, is larger than all sin. Huh. Tells you that predicates, in any case, are larger things than particular subjects, except in one case, God. But that's advanced logic. We'll get to that some other day. But in any event, you'll see that in those, especially those universal, those categorical statements in Venn diagrams. All right, so that's a valid syllogism. How do we know? We note from the X's, from the premises alone, were sufficient to properly exclude everything that's not the case. Okay, let's see four more syllogisms, and then I will leave you alone with Venn diagrams. Four more syllogisms and explanation for why, and I'm not going to torture you. All four of these are invalid. Three, sorry. All three of these are invalid. But we're just getting used to it. And just to mix it up, I'm going to give you two with universal statements, and then I'm going to give you one with a particular statement, just so you can see how you would diagram a particular one. Well, let's look at this. All dogs are mammals, is the first premise. Premise two, no cats are dogs. Aha, the type E statement in there. Wonder how that's going to turn out. Conclusion, no cats are mammals. Okay. Let's just look at this the traditional way. Do I have a middle term? Yep, I have dogs, and they're in both, and they're not in the conclusion. That's good so far. Do I have a major term? I do. It's mammals, and it shows up exactly where it's supposed to. Do I have a minor term? Cats. And that shows up exactly where it's supposed to. Everything's good, right? Well, no, remember, there was a lot of rules for categorical syllogisms. There were seven, to be exact. But some of the most basics were about equivocation and so on. So we have to be looking at that. Now, that's not what happens here, equivocation, but something else happens. So a Venn diagram will help us see what went wrong. Okay? So in my A class, I'll have dogs. In my B class, I'll have mammals. Over on the right, and in the bottom, the third circle, on the bottom, the C class, I will have cats. So, what should I X out? First premise, all dogs are mammals. What should I exclude? Dogs that are not mammals. So I will shade that out. I like on the board, you get to shade it out. You don't have to do X's. It just makes it clear to see. Premise two, no cats are dogs. What do I cross out? Cats that are dogs. That's interesting. Cats that are dogs. Yeah. No cats are dogs. Cats are dogs. But this is weird already. All right. And so I can't even go to my conclusion and say, well, what do I do now? Because you're not supposed to do that anyway. So let's leave that alone for a second and then just look at it. If I see in the conclusion, no cats are mammals, which I know is not sound, but I just want to look at it anyway, what do I see? I see unmammaled cats, but I also see cats that in fact are mammals, even though this told me that they're not. So I know it's invalid. In addition to being unsound, it's also invalid because I need something there. If that was to follow, that would have been crossed out right there. And it's not, so I know that it's not valid either. Okay. Let's move on to this. Second syllogism, draw up my circles again. Premise one, all Europeans are sinners. I didn't say there were worse sinners. I just said all Europeans are sinners. Premise two, no Puritans are Europeans. I'm just trying to spice it up, you know? I could have done better, trust me. Therefore, no Puritans are sinners. Now, hold on a minute now. I agree with that first premise. All Europeans are sinners. And I, you know, as a general rule, Puritans were typically English. You know, you had pietists in Germany, but just, I'll even buy the second one, even if you can't say that. But how does it follow that no Puritans are sinners? All right, well, let's draw this up here. Europeans is going to be my... You just put Euro for the A class. B class on the right, sinners. And the C class on the bottom, Puritans. All right. What should I exclude? First premise, all Europeans are sinners. What should I exclude? Europeans that aren't sinners. So I'm going to cross that out. Okay. No Puritans are Europeans. Yeah. I'm going to cross that. Wait a minute. That looks exactly the same as the last one. Okay. So if I want to say no Puritans are a sinner, I should be able to look at this and see that no S is P, this should have been exclusionary. In other words, it should have looked like this. Not like this. But it does look like this, and it doesn't look like that. Okay? My type East is another way to see it. It's just that, by the way, those things that we looked at before from the traditional square of opposition, those are just Euler diagrams. Those four different relationships. A tight E statement should always look like that. No S is P should always look like S over here in its own circle, P over there with a nice good inch or two in between them, over there in its own P circle. Okay? So, now I'm going to give you one that really mixes things up because I'm going to add a particular statement of some kind in here. And it'll show you there is a different way that we have to diagram these. But it's if you can keep in mind those Euler diagrams that we looked at weeks ago about the four categorical statements, and you remember how to diagram a particular one, you're going to see that it's ultimately the same thing. So let's draw out my circles again. Premise one, all geniuses are talented. Premise two, some doctor is talented. Therefore, some doctor is a genius. All right, so let's look this up in these circles. My A circle on the left top is geniuses. My B circle on the top right is talented. My C circle on the bottom is doctors. In other words, at the risk of being too repetitive, this circle then means all geniuses. That circle means all talented. And that circle means all doctors. So hopefully you've caught that as we've gone. Okay, so let's look at this. First of all, wait a minute. Do I have a middle term? Yes. You say, wait a minute, it's over here now. That's true, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's invalid. Not necessarily. That's going to in this case, but that just means that it's one of the four figures. We've been assuming and looking at the first figure of four. Those Barbara, Celarent, Dari, and Ferio, those are the first figures. Syllogisms in the first figure. This is just a different one. It's perfectly fine in and of itself. We've got a major term. And it shows up as the predicate of the conclusion. We've got a minor term, and it shows up as the subject of the conclusion. So in that respect, it's fine. So now you're seeing the value of then. Checking validity this way can still be done if you remember a lot of stuff, but it's not as apparent. Whereas if you go over here, the fallacy, the violation of the particular law for categorical syllogisms can be detected easier by graphically demonstrating it. So let's start to look at this. Premise one, all geniuses are talented. What should I exclude? Okay. Premise two, some doctor is talented. What do I do here? Some doctor. Okay. Do you remember the way in those categorical propositions we diagram the four ways that you diagram that? And so, and this is a particular affirmative. Some doctor is talented, so some S is P. And you remember that you'd put it in here in the intersecting field, not out here. That would be an O statement. It'd be somewhere in there. So you could do a dot or you can do a check. But what you would do is you would say, some doctor is talented. So you'd put it in this intersecting field between doctors and talented. Now I'm going to show you in a second why you put it here and not here. That's what's going to lead to the antennas going up. So I'm going to put a check mark in the intersecting field most to the right. In other words, closest to 4 o'clock. I don't know how else to describe it. For people not seeing this, the check is going to be in that intersecting field between doctors and talented. Okay, so if I look at my conclusion, I see some doctor is a genius. Do I have everything I need here? Some doctor is a genius.
You haven't established some doctor is talented.
Oh, see, if all geniuses are talented, man, come on, if he's talented, that's the glue. Talent is the glue here. So if all geniuses are talented, well then, if a doctor's talented, he should be related to it somehow, right? Right.
Non-genius.
Yes, you just both said it in a different way. You haven't established yet. You haven't. So yeah, that's exactly right. He may be talented in some other way other than his genius. He may be a really good juggler, and he does that for the encouragement of the patients. Right? Before, I don't know. But he might. You haven't established when you say some doctors. See, the fact that all geniuses are talented, it doesn't follow. Sorry. If all geniuses are talented, it doesn't follow that there's not other talents other than genius, and therefore a particular doctor, boom, right there. A doctor could have that, and a doctor could be both. A doctor could be both genius and talented in other ways, and so forth. Okay, so it may be true that the check is here in some cases. But I haven't established that by this particular argument. That's just a particular affirmative, and I don't have enough information in my premises to do that. So I have something that I need here. And since it's not there, that is an invalid syllogism. It doesn't necessarily follow. Now, there's four more examples of this that you can diagram for yourself on page 226 of Poythress. I think they're good examples. It's a good mixture of valid and invalid and different types. So, maybe do that on your own, on page 226 in Poythress's book, and you will be strangely warmed, as Wesley was when he... Anyway, I'm not guaranteeing that. Okay. Alrighty. Now, let's bring Venn and the square of opposition together, and I will get back to the square of opposition in just a second, but let's just bring it together for a second. Hopefully, we can remember the Barbara and Celerant syllogisms. Before I give you these two syllogisms, let me... Where should I do this? I'm going to draw the top half of the square of opposition, just to tease you. It'll be just hiding. I'm doing this for a reason, trust me. I'm going to do this right above the syllogisms. Remember? Type A statements were up here, 10 o'clock. Type E statements were over there, 2 o'clock. And then on the bottom part of the square, you had the I and O. So this is just the universals kind of peeking up here on our board. The reason I'm doing that is because I want to put a Barbara syllogism up here, and I want to put a Celerant syllogism up here. And I'm going to show you the relationship they have between each other. Again, Poythress does a really good job in this. He shows you both. He shows you the relationship between A and E, and he shows you the relationship between I and O. And the relationship is going to be about conversion or substitution. So we're checking our work, and we're doing it both ways. So let me explain to you what I mean by that. If you can remember those two syllogisms, let me just give you an example of both, of the Barbara and the Celerant form. First of all, the Barbara form. Why do I have that on the right? That's so dumb. I want to have it on the left. Anyway, I'll get it right here. All dogs are non-cats is premise one. Oh, you know what? I am going to hold it. I'm going to wait on that one, which it might be on your notes anyway. I'm going to wait because of what it's doing. So ignore that I just did that. I'll bring it back up in 2 minutes. But if you can remember the relationship between those, so let me do this instead. I'll put A for Barbara. Remember the mood, and then the conclusion was also A. And then for Celerant, E, A, E. That's why they have those names, because of those vowels in those names. Universal affirmatives all the way down, and then the Celerant, you have a universal negative first premise and a universal negative conclusion and an A as a second premise. So that's what they have to do with each other. Okay? So hopefully you remember the square of opposition, the type A statement, and the type E stood in a contrary relationship. So let me put that on this line. Contrary relationship between A and E. Not contradictory, contrary. And there's going to be an important difference between them. Retaining these two pieces of information, those two syllogisms, and the A and the E in the square. If you remember those two pieces of information, they're going to help us use Venn diagrams to represent substitution. One way to check a Celerant syllogism is to substitute the contrary of its negative statements to see if the same values hold. So we're going to move from left to right. Sorry, on this we're actually going to move from right to left, because I should have put it on the right. So we're going to move from right to left. I'm going to give you a Celerant syllogism, and we're going to convert it. And you're saying, who cares? When am I going to be in a classroom checking the validity of a Celerant syllogism and converting it into a Barber syllogism? Well, maybe not, but you may come up to statements in scriptures that say something like, no, something is something. And you have to, oh, that means that all something is non-something. And Josh has already done a couple of those with the logic of the text last week. You're just converting language, okay, which is going to help you logically. So let me give you an example. Give you a Celerant. All, did it again, no dogs are cats. No dogs are cats. That's my first premise. No dogs are cats. Premise two, all collies are dogs. Does Poitras own collies or something? Is it just, what is it? Conclusion, no collies are cats. So you see that? The major premise and the conclusion were both type E statements. Well, let's say that it's not becoming clear to me if it's valid or invalid. One way to check is to draw an arrow this way and to simply convert the statements back into a Barbara syllogism, or maybe into a Barbara syllogism for the first time. You would say, all dogs are non-cats. Now, in normal English, you wouldn't say that, so you wouldn't. Yeah. But you're not doing normal English, you're converting it into logic. So doesn't that mean the same thing as this? Doesn't no dogs are cats really mean the same thing as all dogs are non-cats? Yes. Now, you don't have to do anything to the second premise. You would just keep it, all collies are dogs, because it's a type A, and so is the second premise of a Barbara syllogism. Conclusion, all collies are non-cats. Okay? So, that's all. Now, when you draw up an actual Venn diagram for that, you might panic at first because they're going to look a little bit different. But don't panic. Here's what they'd actually look like. I'm going to have to draw it slightly small because I'm taking up my whole board here. So I'm going to put cats and dogs in my A and B circles and collies down here. And, yeah, I did that backwards again. I'm going to do that on the right for the type E statement. I'm going to have cats as my A circle, dogs as my B circle, collies as the C circle down here. On the type A, I'm going to have non-cats as my A circle, dogs as my B circle, and collies. This is the only thing different is really non-cats. Now, if I do it like that, you should know right away there's going to be X's in different places. That doesn't mean they mean something different. You're just going to test it in a different direction. So, for my type E, I would put an X here, here, and here. Here's where I'd do that. Premise one was no dogs or cats, so I'd have to say right here in the middle. Oh, I should have put one here, too. Did I not do that in the... Uh-huh. Oh, well, I got it right here, because if no dogs are cats, then voila, that whole intersecting field has to be out. Okay? But then also, premise two, all collies are dogs. That means I'm going to have to X out anything from collie land that's not also a dog. And so I should be left with something like that type E Euler relationship, no S is P. And that's exactly what I do have. Look, no cat is a collie. No collie is a cat. Perfect. All right. In the type A, I would have all dogs are non-cats. So what would I have to cross out? Any dog that's in non-cat land. Right there. Same thing. And then I'd have... Follow along. Where am I? Non-cats, yeah. Yeah. Of course, non-cats are anything not a cat. Hold on. Yeah. Let me just shade it like an artist at first. Give me a second, because I did it wrong to begin with. Where am I? All collies. Okay, so all dogs are non-cats. Non-cats. That was right. Right. Because they could also be non-other things, like everything else that's not a dog. That's kind of the problem here. So let's just artichoke that again. All collies are dogs. So this will be easier. Thank you. All collies are dogs. So that means immediately you have to cross out all of that. You better leave something there. So that can't be crossed out. Just give me a second here. And then conclusion. I keep losing it on the page. There it is. All collies are non-cats. So, hold on now. Because no collie could be not a dog, though. So you could just leave this one open and still have that be non-cat, but that's a non-cat. That's a... this whole thing is all busted up. But that's the goal, is to have it all busted up. That's indeed. Okay? Yeah. Let's get back to that one after class. I messed it up in my diagram there, so that... I got us on the wrong track. We'll do that after. We'll come back to it. Because now you got me annoyed. All right. Here's the point, though. The Celerant can be converted to Barbara and the Barbara back to Celerant. And why is that? Because the type A Barbara and the type E Celerant stand in a contrary relationship to each other. Contrary relationship to each other. This is saying all S's P. This is saying no S's P. Leave that up. In fact, this is where I might be. Yes, it is. Let me just draw up the square now. The whole thing. And remember, the whole purpose of the square of opposition was immediate inferences. And this is the traditional square of opposition. I'm going to show you one thing about the modern square of opposition in just a second and show you why it was done. It creates a logical problem, a philosophical problem. In fact, it was done on philosophical grounds, not logical grounds. As all modern things typically are, confusion of categories. Okay, you remember, hopefully, type A statement's universal affirmative, all S is P. Type E statement, universal negative, no S is P. I know that's going to get in the way, isn't it? But who cares? Type A on the bottom, some S is P. Type O on the bottom right, some S is not P. Okay? When we introduced the square of opposition, we defined an immediate deduction or an immediate inference as a deduction that can be drawn directly from a statement without knowing anything else. So it's very much closer to the a priori. So what you're doing here, an immediate deduction or an immediate inference is basically if A, then B. It's immediate. There's no mediating categories. It's not even as big as a syllogism. By contrast, immediate inference, you're more building. That's one way to graphically demonstrate it right there. There's lots of ways to do it, but that's immediate inference. So, you might say it like this, an immediate inference is just an inference having only one premise. Why is the square of opposition going to help us do that? Because if you know that, or if you assume that one of them is the case, that will immediately imply something about all three of the other relationships. They'll be related to each other in a very particular way. So when we understand an immediate inference this way, we'll see that no matter what propositional type we start from, A, E, I, or O, there will only be 16 possible combinations of immediate inferences. Now, if you read Clark, for example, on page 55, you'll see that there's 32 moods and 64 permutations. Fun stuff. You can check that out if you want to. But the point being, and here's one way to see it, the different combinations are simply this. You can have an A and what it implies about A, an A and what it implies about E, an A and what it implies about I, A and what it implies about O, and so on. I think you get the idea with the other ones too, dot, 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 all the way down to O. So that's why it's 16 different combinations. But only 6 of these 16 combinations are valid. So that's important too. Okay? So, what we're going to do here is we're just going to draw out a little chart, which I think, I'm sure I have this in your notes. And that is the different combinations that if A is true, and so on with the other three. And then there's four for if A is false, and so on with the other three. So if they're true, or if they're false, it's going to imply something about the other. So let's do it like this, the easiest way to do it. Let's put T over here, F over here. There's going to be my assumption. I'm going to assume, and then over here I'm going to put inference. Well, I'll just put implies. Assume, implies. There you go. Okay? So if I put, if I assume A, that's going to imply something about E, I, and O. If I assume E, it's going to imply something about A, I, and O. If I assume I, you get the idea. And I'm going to show you what they are. And this is always the case, in every case. Now, this is false. I can do the same board over here. If they're false, that'll imply. And I'll show you what they are in a second, and we're going to see why, by just looking at it. Man, need more board. Need a smart board one day. Just right in the air. Wouldn't that be awesome? Anyway. Okay, so this is what it looks like. We also need color chalk. Running out quickly, but that's okay. I think this will do. Okay, so if A is true, then E is false, I is true, O is false. Let's look at that over here. Why is that the case? So if all S is P, then no S is P would be false. Okay? That's the contrary relationship. If all S is P, then I is true. Why is that the case? Why is it that if all bears are brown, then some bear is brown? Yeah. And this is exactly what the modern square of opposition is going to oppose. And I'll show you why. And it's an atheistic... Mathematics is not theistic or atheistic. Yes, it is. Stay tuned. If A is true, all S is P, then O is false. Why? Well, these, my nice Confederate flag. This is a contradictory relationship. A with O, and while we're at it, I with E. These are in a contradictory relationship. So, if all S is P, and I show you, if all bears are brown, and I say, some bear is not brown, is that a contradictory statement? Absolutely. All I have to do is show you one, and that's why the contradiction to 6 is not 12. It's not 6. The contradiction to there are 6 people in this room is not, no, there's 12 people in this room. That's contrary. But the contradiction to there are 6 people in this room is there are not 6 people in this room. So we have to understand what logic is doing and what it's not doing. Okay, and so on with all the other categories. Now, the only thing I'm going to show you here, because we don't have time to get into all of it, is on these middle four, the I and the O, if they're true, and the E and the A, if they're false, that leaves at least one, now at least the other two, undetermined. So let's see what undetermined is, because the other ones are pretty straightforward. These ones are going to be undetermined. Let's see why that is. If I is true, some bear is brown, for example. A and O are undetermined. Why would that be? If some bear is brown, does it follow that all bears are brown? No, not necessarily. That's not false, it's just undetermined. So now we see what that means right away. On the other hand, if some bear is brown, then O, if you say some bear is not brown, have I contradicted you? No, because you could be talking about Winnie and I could be talking about Yogi. Or something. Okay, it's undetermined. Alright, it doesn't necessarily exclude or negate the existence of that other proposition. And so on with the others. These are the undetermined category. So that's on your notes. And enjoy that. The example I had that I was going to get into, but you know, just for time's sake, I won't. The example I get into in all of them was all things took place to fulfill prophecy. That was the example I used. Let's just do that one with one of them. And let's just start with the type E statement. So I would say no things took place to fulfill prophecy. So if I say that, let's do that over there.
No things took place to fulfill prophecy. And we're going to assume that that's true, that type B statement. If I start with that assumption and I move out that way, what would I be left with? Well, the type A statement, all things took place to fulfill prophecy, would have to be false on the basis of a contrary relationship. The proposition, I, that something, only one thing, that's all you need, took place to fulfill prophecy, would have to be false on the basis of a contradictory relationship. The proposition, oh, something did not take place to fulfill prophecy, would have to be true on the basis of a subaltern relationship. I didn't write all those down, but remember the subaltern relationship. Because, why would that have to be true? Again, same thing as over there. All bears are brown and some bears brown. Likewise, if no thing took place to fulfill prophecy, then that particular thing that Matthew's gospel said, this took place to fulfill prophecy, would have to be false. And it's contrary. Something did not take place to fulfill prophecy, would have to be true. Now, I can say the same thing by saying, that thing, Jesus riding on a donkey, was purely coincidence or was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Suppose I said that. Would I be saying the same thing as the type O statement? Yes, in different words. When you translate it into logic, you would say that means that this thing, him riding on into Jerusalem with a donkey, is not taking place to fulfill prophecy. Okay? And you could do that with any of the other combinations, and I won't torture you with them, but I'm just giving you that one example to show you why it's relevant. Okay. There's other relationships that were implied in our introduction to categorical propositions, but which we did not include. If you want to look at these, the reflexive, the symmetrical, and the transitive, see Gordon Clark's book, which you should order one of these days, after you read the Poitras book. Read Gordon Clark's book as well on logic. That's page 41 and 42. He gets into those relationships. But the ones that are the most important in logic textbooks are called conversion, obversion, and contraposition. I'll define them. They're in your notes. Let me erase these. And the only reason I'm bringing it up here in so short a space, because I can't get into it as far as working out the whole system of logic, the only reason I want to bring it up now is just to remind you again, this is ultimately what you're doing when you translate from English, say, for example, a proposition in the Scriptures, or a sentence in the Scriptures, to the propositions of logic. Is you're ultimately working with a contrapositive, for example. And you say, well, I've never used that word before in my life. Yeah, but that's what you were doing. So let's look at that. First of all, conversion. And there's only three of these, and I'll try to work through them fast. Conversion. Conversion is the interchanging of the subject and predicate, and this can be done with E and I, but not for A and O. So, over here is going to be a given statement, and over here is going to be the converse. We would just call it the converse of given statement. So there's going to be an E and an I. This will not work for A and O. And we'll see why that is. If we say no S is P, so for example, no prophecy, no thing took place to fulfill prophecy, the converse is no P is S. Which would be no prophecy was of a thing to take place. No, yeah, something like that. And remember how you would diagram that? Totally separate. Okay? You used to be flip-flopping them. Type I statement. Some S is P. What would be the converse of that? Some P is S. So you get it, so I won't even write it on the board. That's the converse. So sometimes we'll say, conversely, blah, 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 blah. It's somewhat important to get those things right, just like pronunciation. You don't want to be dinged by somebody who says, well, actually, the way to pronounce that is like this, you know, like you're on Jeopardy and it's Alex Trebek following you around. It's really annoying. Okay, you don't want to get dinged for that. So when we say conversely, we have to mean flip-flopping S and P. And only in the case of E and I. Aha. Secondly, obversion. Isn't there inversion too? Isn't that when the sky? No. Obversion. This is, so I'm going to give you the given, and then I'll give you the obverse. Now, that's a word you probably wouldn't use in everyday language. But it's somewhat important to know that it's not the same thing as the converse. Okay, so here, this will work for all of them. Okay, so all SSP would be... No, sorry, I didn't tell you what it is yet. Obversion is replacing one form with another by contradicting the predicate of the first and therefore changing the quality of the proposition. So if I say non-something, I'm changing the quality of the proposition. I'm denying the relationship between S and P, whereas before I was affirming it. Before I was saying all S is P. Now I'm going to say no S is non-P. Non-P. Okay, but there's going to be translations happening here. This gives you grounds to translate sentences into propositions of logic. E, no S is P. I could say all S is non-T. Or, particular affirmative, some S is P. I would say some S is not non-P. No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't say that in a million years. Well, I know that in regular speech. But we're just showing, and sometimes you can find something in regular speech, say, wait a minute, he's just saying the same thing in different words. And in fact, how many times do you have to do that with the devil? Because the devil is always going to try to give you the same lie in different wrapping paper every time. And so this becomes a powerful tool of deconstruction. Type O statement, some S is not P, you could say some S is non-P. Non-P. So with this affirmative, you could say not non-P. You say, well, that's a double negative. I know, but a double negative gets you a positive, so that's why we're saying it. Okay? That's the obverse. Okay. Last one, contrapositive. So you call this contraposition. And look at the Latin, or the English of the Latin. Against. And posit. Okay? So contraposition is contradicting both the subject and predicate and interchanging them. This can be done with A and O, but not with E and I. Okay? So if I want to say all S is P, I could say all non-P is non-S. And if I wanted to say some S is not P, I could say some non-P is not non-S. And that's really torture. But I had to, some non-P is not non-P. Okay? Yeah.
That's clear.
Yeah, sure it is. But is language clear? It should be, but is it? And so that's why that becomes important. Now, that's not going to be readily memorable, except that it's tortured. But in other respects, it won't be. But again, that's as thick as we're getting on that square. That's pretty good for the thickest part you get on that square. Okay? So this becomes important in immediate inferences. And the more immediate you can make an inference, especially when you're disentangling somebody who's intentionally being deceptive, the better. So here you have hard things meant to make things easier. Just like big words. Why do you have to use so many big words? Because if I didn't, what took me 5 seconds to say, and now has your head ringing, would have taken me 5 hours to say and would have had everybody's head ringing. I just clarified something by something hard. Hard things make things easier, and there's no other way through it. Hard things make things easier. Okay, what about, last thing, what about this modern square of opposition? Here's what it would look like first. Let me leave that up there, actually. And the purpose, the stated purpose of the modern square of opposition is to simplify, so we are told. Well, some people are told, and then other people are told more, and so on and so forth. It's going to look the same. It's going to have the same sentences. all S is P, no S is P, some S is P, some S is not P. And this is sometimes, and instead of being called the modern square, it will be sometimes called the Boolean square after that mathematician George Boole, who developed a lot of algebraic type expressions of this. But the Boolean square is simplified, but that's because what is eliminated are assumptions. So I'm going to draw a dotted line that they won't draw, but it's implied, right through the heart of our little Confederate flag. And above that line, you'll recognize this in philosophy as universals. And below that line, you'll recognize as particulars. And by the way, so will they. Because the statements, of course, are still called, at least at first, we recognize them as universal affirmatives, universal negatives, and so on and so forth. But you'll notice that wherever possible, the word particular is now going to be called existential. And have you ever asked yourself, why do they do that? I didn't. On the first day of math class, I said, you slippery little satanic. Because I knew right away, they didn't mean existential like Jean-Paul Sartre existential. Take some drugs after you do math class. They meant existent. As opposed to general things which are not things at all. Alrighty. So what is streamlined are assumptions. What assumptions imply are universal categories that do not correspond to anything real in the world, which are material things, as we all know. They don't say all that, but that's the parentheses. Thus, type A and E statements do not assert any existent thing. Gone are the contrary, the subcontrary, and subaltern relations. All that is left is contradictory relationships, and all they're good for is to criticize the internal makeup of statements, which turns out none of the things are about real things. Let's recall the existential fallacy. I brought it up 2 weeks ago. Hurley, in his logic, further describes this as occurring, the existential fallacy, when the let me draw that up in a syllogism, what the existential fallacy would do. If I say, all something is something, some something of that is something, therefore some of that is something. That is always fallacious. It's called the existential fallacy. Why? Well, because if I say all bears are brown, and if I say we just saw a bear, I cannot say, we just saw a brown thing. Not because the modern logician denies the existence of you, or that you were just at Yellowstone, or that brownness is a color, or that a bear is a thing. If you mean that particular bear, or existent, or glob of protoplasm that got some hair on it and can do some damage to your car. But if you really mean any of these things, you don't mean anything at all. I'm sorry, what? Isn't that backwards? Why are you getting my tax money? You simpleton. You deceptive simple. You can't possibly believe that. You can't possibly believe that. What's happening here? Big circle. Bears are brown. All S is P. If I say all S is P, I'm not talking about anything. I'm talking about all of that thing. And there is no such thing as all of that thing. There is only that bear right over there. What's happening here? Naturalistic assumptions are defining mathematics and logic. Who let these idiots in? Answer, we did. Christians did. And it's all throughout the textbooks, and somebody has to correct them. He says, Hurley, quote, when the traditional square of opposition is used in conjunction with propositions that make assertions about things that do not actually exist. Got that out of that? Out of that square there? Out of that Confederate flag? Or did you make a philosophical assumption? An a priori assumption? Which assumptions you don't believe exist? And then deduce naturalism from it. And then read that into the square of opposition. So Hurley says, in other words, it occurs, this fallacy, when the relations of contrary, subcontrary, and subalternation are used, parentheses, in a manner that would normally yield a determinate truth value, normally, to draw inferences from propositions whose subject terms denote empty classes. Empty classes will be code word for everything. See everything in that circle? No, you don't, because there's nothing in that circle. A generic statement. Now, people used to believe that back in the Middle Ages when monks had nothing to do and they were sexually repressed. They used to believe that universals were real things. But we now know, through the magic of just saying it over and over again and nobody really calling us on the carpet for it, we now know that there is no such thing other than a material particular. Okay? But what did we already see about predication in those Venn diagrams? So, for example, Collies, let's just call one particular one, which is apparently the only one that exists now, Sam. Sam the Collie. Dogs. Animals. Now, Venn comes along in the atmosphere bull, and says, I'll play with this. This is a Euler diagram. What I'm going to say is still going to function for this. This is still going to make sense. But since we know that these aren't real, we're just going to streamline it. The problem there is that when you streamline it, you come to find out my A class is dogs, my B class is animals, my C class is collies. I'm going to start Xing out all that I need to X out. You come to find out that this thing is still entirely made up of these things. What things? Hair. What's hair? Well, it's that right there. Oh yeah, what's that right there? Well, it's a follicle. You put it under the microscope and you see what? What do you see? Well, you see molecules are made of this and the protein and the blah, blah. Okay, what's that made of? Oh, well, atoms and, okay, what's an atom? Well, an atom is just two things buzzing around. What's thing and what's buzzing and what's around? What are those? Well, there's quarks and the superstring and the blues, and then you, what did you just say? Does anything exist according to your idea? Does any particular thing, so let's do this with a spider chart. And let's take a ball. We'll take a blue ball, and we'll take a blue bouncy ball, and we'll put all these predicates here, blue and bouncy, and well, how'd it get that way? Well, it's rubber, and so on and so forth. Well, let's put it in the fire for a second. And you say, well, it starts to lose its blueness, doesn't it? It loses its rubberness and it's losing... No, it doesn't. It just burns up in those particles. What particles? And when you strip it down at the end of the day, there's nothing there except its predicates. And of its predicates, we can say that all of these exist apart from this particular. What's blueness? Is it that ball? Of course not. Well, what is it then? Is that thing over there blue? The water? And the sky? And this, what is blueness? And likewise, bounciness. What is bounciness? Aren't other things bouncy? Would bouncy be bouncy apart from that ball? When this ball passes from existence, will rubber still be rubber? And when that rubber passes from existence, will, I don't know, plastic and other such things, that are those things still things? And you do that with everything, and at the end of the day, nothing exists. And this is what the lesson people should have got from Kant. If you eliminate the stuff above the line, you're really eliminating the stuff below the line too. Because the stuff below the line is entirely made up of the stuff above the line. Paul said so, Romans 1:20. The invisible things of Him are clearly perceived in the things that have been made ever since the creation of the world, so that they are without excuse. These mathematicians should be deposed from their positions. They have no excuse, and neither do we if we continue to let them do what they're doing.